This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Poet Peter Balakian wrote a coming-of-age memoir a few years ago that told of his discovery of his family's experience of the Armenian genocide. That put him on course to write a history of what has been called the Hidden Holocaust. Peter Balakian is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with him about his new book, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Balakian's previous book, the memoir I mentioned, is called Black Dog of Fate. For many readers, it was an introduction to the horrors of the first genocide of the 20th century, a genocide that inspired Hitler. Why was the Armenian genocide forgotten? What had Americans known of it, and how did they respond? These are some of the questions Peter Balakian takes up in The Burning Tigris. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number to use, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter Balakian is the author of seven previous books, including June Tree, New and Selected Poems, 1974 to 2000. He is the recipient of the Penn Martha Allbrand Award for Memoir for Black Dog of Fate. He's received many other honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship. Peter Balakian teaches at Colgate University. His new book, The Burning Tigris, published by HarperCollins, has made the New York Times bestseller list. It will appear on Sunday's list at number 4. Peter joins us this afternoon from Chicago, where this evening, Tuesday, October 14th, 2003, he will appear at North Park College on West Foster Avenue, that address, 3225 West Foster. That event gets underway at 7:30. 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Peter Balakian, thank you so much. Welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, Celeste. It's great to be with you.
Armenia is a country that was part of the Soviet Union, but its history goes back so much farther. In the 19th century, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. And it was at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century that more than 1 million Armenians were killed at the hands of the Turks, who to this day deny what happened. This is a history that has been lost for some time, but there was a time when it was well known. How was it that it became lost, forgotten, for such a period of time?
Well, you have to go back to the early 1920s in the immediate aftermath of World War I and the machinations of the, I'm sorry about that here.
Yeah, is there anybody who can answer it? Or
They were supposed to block it. I told them to block it.
Let me reintroduce you, and why don't you go pick it up? How about that?
Okay, well, now it's off.
Now it's off. Okay, very
I'm
good.
Sorry.
Now it's nothing to be apologizing
hiding,
for.
Hiding away here, away from phones. So if you go back to the early 1920s, you find that the cause for Armenia was very big in Europe and the United States, the cause for justice. But during the peace treaty and the immediate aftermath, there was a revolution in Turkey, and Mustafa Kemal, known as Ataturk, came to power and consolidated a new Turkish republic. The new Turkish republic was determined to have the Western powers drop the Armenian question, as it was called, from the radar screen. And they campaigned vehemently against any allotment of land, territory, recognition, acknowledgement, remuneration for the Armenian genocide. And the Western powers, I mean, there's a different story with each power, but for the most part, Europe was exhausted from World War I and lost interest in the Armenian question. and the United States turned Republican isolationist, I should say isolationist Republicans led the charge against America's interests in global arenas, and also the Harding administration's new interest in brokering oil diplomacy in the Middle East made it much more likely that America would now make friends with Turkey, which was then sitting on the Mosul oil fields. They didn't go to Iraq until the late 1920s. And so we began to become complicit with the Turkish government in denying what we had only years earlier had been deeply engaged in as an international human rights issue. And from the 20s on, you find what had been the largest international human rights question in Europe and the United States in the first decades of the 20th century quickly disappear down the amnesia hole, so that you go decades into the 20th century without hearing about the Armenian genocide until a discourse reemerged, I would say, in the mid to late 1960s. And ever since, there's been a gradual and continual evolution of knowledge and books and scholarship, and I think now we're really at a very exciting place as this history is starting to come dramatically into the mainstream.
Yeah. In the 1960s, as you say, there were some sparks that led to a beginning of Armenian genocide memory. What allowed for the beginning of this memory?
Well, in 1965, there was this really dramatic 50th anniversary celebration, commemoration. It was a worldwide phenomenon. Armenians really came out of the woodwork all over the Soviet Union, in North America and South America and the Middle East, to recognize, commemorate, and begin to talk more seriously about the meaning of the Armenian genocide. So this was a threshold moment. And then I believe that the cultural and social conditions of the United States in the 1960s and early 70s made it a fertile arena for human rights, commemoration, collective memory to come onto a more civic platform. I think the anti-war movement regarding Vietnam, I think the African-American civil rights movement, I think the development of a new phase of American feminism, I think the interest in psychotherapy and a therapy culture, an understanding of trauma, I think all of these things came together, and perhaps, too, the beginning of a Holocaust studies discourse, these things came together to make a fertile arena for Armenians who had been standing in the shadows for decades now to come forward and to speak in a civic sense about the importance of the century's first genocide.
Mm. Any chips in Turkey's attitude toward the genocide? In the book, you note that as late as the 1970s, the Turkish government was pressuring the press in Turkey not to use the word genocide. What has the Turkish media done, and what's the situation in Turkey today?
Well, you know, as I have begun to write about in Black Dog of Fate, the Turkish government's program of denial has been total and sinister, as a number of scholars in the genocide and Holocaust studies field have called it. They have gone around the world to try to coerce and bully other governments and other states, the media and the press, into denying the Armenian genocide, into censoring it, into covering it up. This has become really an international ethical issue. In Turkey, the Armenian genocide is taboo. It can get no recognition or acknowledgement from the government or from the institutions that control Turkish society. And sadly, one would have to say, Turkey has no democratic culture. Even though they have a parliament and they are, in a kind of legalistic sense, a democracy, there is no open culture, there is no free press, there is no free inquiry in their educational system. And sadly, in response to the evolution of the Armenian genocide discourse, the Turkish government has now begun to fight even more horrifically. They're now mandating that the denial of the genocide be taught in Turkish public schools. And so in that sense, things are at a terrible kind of Cold War. But in another sense, there's some movement in Turkey, too. There are Turkish scholars who are coming forward. There are Turkish historians who are acknowledging that this indeed was genocide, that it was organized and planned by the Ottoman government in 1915. And there's even one very brave Turkish scholar at the University of Minnesota, Taner Akcan, who has written three books in Turkish on the Armenian genocide, and his kind of work is really groundbreaking, and I hope it's a sign for things to change.
Yeah. Well, with the appearance of this book on the bestseller list, that's incredible.
Yes, it is hard to believe in a way. It's exciting because what means so much to me is that this history that has waited so long in the shadows and is so important to an understanding of modernity, so important to the understanding of the 20th century, that this history finally achieve what might be its proper place in the larger history of the world. And I hope that the bestseller list is a kind of sign of that to come.
Mm. We've mentioned Black Dog of Fate. Maybe you would tell us how it was that you, a third-generation Armenian-American, learned of this history.
Well, in my memoir, I write about how this history was not talked about openly in my growing up. My grandmother, my only surviving grandparent, my maternal grandmother was a death march survivor and had an extraordinary experience. I wrote about that in some detail in my memoir. But nobody wanted to talk openly about the genocide of 1915. And so I discovered growing up that, I would get little fragments and bits, and I came to think of these fragments and bits of knowledge as encoded messages. And it really wasn't until I was old enough on my own as a young writer that I began to explore more deeply to begin to find out where those encoded messages were coming from. And the end of my memoir deals with how this entire history then came out into the open for me, and how my grandmother was no longer living, but how my aunts and my one aunt, who was a child on the death march, how they began to speak openly. And it was an enormously powerful catharsis to be able to have this history kind of in my own upper consciousness, if you will.
Mm. The killings before 1915 of the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century are called massacres. 1950 we call genocide.
Right.
Would you talk about that and the meaning of genocide, and would it be accurate to say that genocide evolves within a culture of massacre?
Yeah, yes. To answer your last question, indeed it does. And let me go back to the 1890s and say some things, because this history may even be more unknown to our listeners. In the 1890s, the Sultan Abdulhamid II, in response to persistent Armenian requests for reform and change, and I would remind everybody that the Armenians were the largest Christian minority in the central and eastern part of what is today Turkey. Armenians were living on their ancient homeland of 2,500 years, and were the first, Armenia was the first nation to make Christianity its state religion in 301, a little bit before Rome did. So Armenians as Christians living under Muslim rule faced a lot of discrimination and a lot of second-class citizenship, and they were known as infidels, gavur, as were all of the Christian minorities, the Greeks and the Assyrians as well. Armenians' request for reform was finally answered by the Sultan with massacre, which began in the spring of 1894 at Sassoon and continued for 2 years. In the end, 200,000 Armenians were killed. This was earth-shattering to the Western world. Nobody, at least in recent modern memory, collective memory, could recall a head of state massacring 200,000 of his own citizens. The Armenians were unarmed, stateless citizens of the Ottoman Empire. So those massacres were groundbreaking. But I would say, as a scholar of genocide, they wouldn't be genocidal in the sense that it wasn't the Sultan's intention in 1896 to eliminate the entire Armenian population because of their identity and their racial makeup. But by 1915, the program implemented by the Committee of Union and Progress, or known in the more vernacular as the Young Turk Government, that really was a program that was state-organized and state-implemented and finally tuned, aimed at the extermination of an entire people and based on that people's identity and cultural belonging. And so there we have an unambiguous case of genocide and what all genocide scholars agree is the first modern genocide and in some way a template for the genocide in the 20th century to follow. And as you mentioned so correctly, the Armenian genocide did inspire Adolf Hitler, who made a statement to his military advisors 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. But I also think that the 1890s massacres did begin to create a culture of massacre by devaluing and dehumanizing Armenians to such an extent that it would be a lot easier to motivate people to kill them in 1915 with World War One on as a kind of screen and World War One creating a kind of total war atmosphere in which people are armed, ready to kill, and fiercely obsessed with national security. And so then the button was pushed for the next level of the unimaginable crime.
Peter Balakian is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his new book, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with our caller on line one in Champaign County.
Yeah, just as a frontispiece, I guess. I guess it's correct to talk of an Armenian diaspora, and one of the places they went to was Palestine. I'm one of the most engaging Palestinians I ever met was you know half Armenian, and I think they were given kind of a refuge there. So they were fleeing Turkic peoples, but they did find some kind of place to. I don't know how well they were accepted, but they did integrate somewhat into the society there. You talked about the implications for modernity. I think that refers to the fact that Ataturk is called, you know, the great modernizer, the great Europeanizer, but he's also the great, you know, author of genocide. So it's not so unalloyed of, you know, and Turkey is still talked to this day as being, you know, the Islamic State that has a chance for democracy better than others because of its modernizing influence by Ataturk. And I think you probably have a brief on that. But I'd also want to point out that this is contemporary in some ways. In Azerbaijan, there's still kind of a cold peace between the Turkic peoples and Armenian enclave. And we also have the other things that Turkey is doing now, which is with U.S. money, you know, scorching the earth in Kurdistan and consequently not being persona grata by any of the council of Iraqi that the U.S. even handpicked. But that is a bit of a digression, but I'm sure you have something to say about the others. I think I have to go and listen off the air. Thanks.
I'll respond to a few of those remarks briefly. First is that Ataturk was not involved in the planning of the Armenian genocide. He came to power in 1921, 2021, and 22 after World War One. He was in the Ottoman army, and he certainly knew about the extermination of the Armenians. But the The directors of the Genocide of the Armenians were the triumvirate that composed the Committee of Union and Progress Government, Talat, Enver, and Jamal, and other fanatical pan-Turkish nationalists like Bedahin Shakir, Nazim, Ziya Gökalp, but not yet Ataturk then. Yes, you note the Armenian diaspora went into the Middle East. That's absolutely true, and I would remind you that the Armenian experience with the Arab world was very positive, and Armenians found very good homes in Lebanon, in Syria, and other parts of the Middle East. And we have to remember, too, that the Arabs had been treated brutally by the Ottomans during the, especially in the last phase of the Ottoman Empire, and their separation and freedom from the Ottoman Empire came after World War I as a great revolutionary moment for the Middle East. Yes, the situation of the Kurds in Turkey today is really a very tragic one. Kurdish people constitute some 12 to 15 million people of Turkey. That's an enormous minority. And ironically, although the Kurds were involved in killing the Armenians in the 1890s, in fact, Kurdish warriors and soldiers comprised the entirety of Sultan Abdulhamid's Hamidai, which were the special troops sent out to massacre Armenians, and Kurds were involved in a lot of killing in 1915. They thought they were going to be able to take over the lands that they cohabited with the Armenians, and especially in the eastern part of Turkey. Sadly, what happened was that the Kurds became the next Armenians in Turkey, and I think this underscores one of the true tragedies of Ataturk's revolution, and that is the fanatical nationalism of that society that disallows for any minority identity or minority status. The Kurdish people have been not allowed to speak their own language. They can't even call themselves Kurds. They still are called Mountain Turks by the Turkish government. They're not allowed to wear their own native costume, and they've been brutalized and killed in the tens of thousands, and they too have been seeking reform and change and civil rights and human rights, and they've been met with a violence similar to the violence that was meted out on the Armenians. Mm.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Go ahead.
Yes, you actually just answered my question. It was about the Kurdish involvement. I'm just wondering, did they actually work with the Turks, or did they have their own special hatred of the Armenians?
Well, I think, no, they were really conscripted by the Ottoman government to do the specialized killing. As I mentioned, in the 1890s, they were the full body of the Hamidai regiments, and in the teens, there were many, many Kurdish men in the killing squads. They had animus toward the Armenians because they also were competing. They felt competitive over historic homeland, and they were Muslim, and the Armenians were Christian. So there was cultural tension, but the cultural tension was articulated and raised to a new level by the Ottoman government.
You also mentioned earlier in the program that there are still passing disinformation about what actually happened. I remember it seemed back in the 70s, I think there was a professor who actually wrote something to the effect that the Armenian massacre never happened. Are you suggesting that sort of rhetoric is still going on?
Well, there was a lot of rhetoric like that among a handful of scholars in the Turkish studies field. Most of them, as I understand it, in some way or other, are rewarded by the Turkish government, whether it be by grants, by summer, lavish summer fellowships in Turkey, and so forth. And so such books were coming out in the 70s and 80s, and I think even into the early 90s. I am not aware of what is happening among American Turkologists at this very moment, But my general sense is that with the strengthening and the breadth of the Armenian genocide discourse and the degree to which this history is being attended to by so many scholars of genocide in so many different disciplines, that the Turkologist deniers are beginning to seem quieter and quieter and quieter.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. I invite your questions for Peter Balakian, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to the idea of genocide denial and the fate of the Kurds. It seems to me that there's a link there, that the Kurds are in trouble for as long as this genocide denial continues.
That the Kurds in Turkey today are in trouble as long as... Yes, I think that's very well put. I think that at the cornerstone of Turkey's human rights problem is the refusal to come to terms with the extermination of the Armenians. It's as if it's the plug in the, you know, that needs to be unstopped from the bottle so that there can be a kind of flow of collective memory, of conscience, and of public affirmation of that conscience in Turkey. And the Kurds are now living there, and they're stuck in a society that allows for no minority rights and allows for no critical examination of itself. And I think that the Armenian case would be very unburdening to Turkey. It would free Turkey up, and it would allow it first to come to terms with a history now that's well enough behind it so that it should feel a little less threatened by examining the history of 1915. But if it were able to examine the history of 1915, I think this would bode well for the Kurdish people, because they would now be received by a different kind of culture.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good afternoon. This is not to say I disagree with your basic contention that, you know, it was a terrible tragedy and that the Turks would be better off if they recognized their own genocide. So is the United States. Would be better off if it recognized a few of its genocides, too. But I wonder if you could address, like, the context of the time that happened. I mean, they just had two Balkan wars there. The Turks had lost, you know, Bosnia had been lost to the Austrians, et cetera. I wonder if you could address, you know, what the mindset of that was sort of driving this, or to what extent there was a sort of a protectionist or protective mindset driving what happened.
Yes, and I certainly spend a lot of time on the context for the genocide in the Burning Tigris. I would point to a number of large factors. The Ottoman Empire was collapsing, and in times of low self-esteem and crisis, cultures are more prone to solve problems with mass violence. I mean, this has been affirmed by many social scientists. Irvin Staub's wonderful book, The Roots of Evil, dwells on the whole idea of culture in crisis as a precondition for genocide. And I think that Turkey was suffering financially. The Ottoman Empire was in great debt to Europe. The Ottoman Empire was losing the Christian Balkans from the 1870s on, you know, Bulgaria, Montenegro, parts of Greece, and so on. Serbia, what is today the former Yugoslavia, all of those cultures were slowly breaking away. There was a great deal of insecurity and panic among Ottoman rulers, and they viewed the Armenians as an enormous threat. Although the Armenians were an unarmed minority people, the Armenians had at least symbolically some support from Europe. The Europeans were interested that the Eastern Christians of the Ottoman Empire get better conditions. There was no secessionist movement among Armenians. Armenians had no army, nor were they, you know, they clamoring to start an independent state, but they really wanted to change the status of their lives in the Ottoman Empire. And making those demands in a time of great insecurity and low self-esteem and financial stress did create a very combustible situation. It didn't have to go up in genocidal flames, but other factors interceded. For example, World War I was another cofactor in the genocidal evolution, as well as the support Turkey got from Germany. Germany was Turkey's wartime ally, and the Germans were very huge on nationalism and on strong military and on a negative attitude toward unwanted minorities. So those are some factors.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Next, we go to a listener in southeastern Illinois on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, from what you've said, most of the killings seem to be just outright slaughter, but well into the 30s in this country, anyone, particularly a child, who didn't clean their plate, eat all their food at mealtime, was reminded how much, quote, the starving Armenians, end quote, would value that food. Was part of the genocide through starvation?
It turned out to be, certainly. I would note this, the just to give you an overview of the killing process, the special organization, as it was known, was a branch of the Committee of Union and Progress, a little bit like the SS being a branch of the Nazi government, that organized killing squads. And the killing squads were made up of largely convicts who were let out of prison, some 30,000. Convicts from prison making up the killing squads. The deportations were started with the wholesale arrests of the men who were often taken out into the fields and the steppe regions outside of towns and villages where they were slaughtered en masse. They were executed by rifle or bayonet. And then the women and children and the elderly were put on deportations. They were told, just the way the Nazis told the Jews, that you're just going to be relocated during wartime. They were told they were just going to be relocated. But within, of course, hours of these marches, it soon became clear that the women were all going to be raped, as I think the rape experience, the sexual violence experience of Armenian women in the Armenian genocide is an astonishing history and something that needs as much exploration as it can get. I do pay a lot of attention to it in my history. But the women and children and elderly were brutalized. Most of them died. The remnants of those death marches, when they arrived in the southern areas like Aleppo, today in Syria, of course, then still Ottoman Empire, when they arrived in Aleppo, those remaining Armenians were the ones who were seen as the starving Armenians, because they were famine ravished, and the image of the starving Armenians got into the American press through the photographs that were taken by the Near East Relief Foundation, which was part of America's extraordinary philanthropic response to the Armenian genocide from the time it began. And those photographs of starving Armenians came back into the American press that way.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Peter Balakian, our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about his new book, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. This was interesting to read, this part of the history that you tell in The Burning Tigris. The American Christian activism that fueled the interest in this country of in the Armenian question and in of the situation of the Armenians. If the Armenians were Christian, why were American missionaries going to Armenia?
Right. That's a good question. Well, originally they saw themselves going to Muslim Ottoman Empire with the hope of converting Muslims to Christianity. But it became clear quickly that that was impossible. And any Muslim who went near Christianity, and there were cases of a few people who, Turkish people who were on their way to converting, they were often killed by their own families. So it became clear that they weren't going to have any luck among the Muslim population, and they found their best customers among the Armenians, who were Orthodox Christians, Apostolic Christians, Eastern Rite Christians. And many of those Christians got interested in Protestantism, and so there evolved quite quickly an Armenian Protestant church. It sort of, you know, warped off from the mainstream apostolic church. But even for the large numbers of Armenians who didn't convert to Protestantism, they became passionate students at the vast network of missionary high schools, grammar schools, and colleges all over the Ottoman Empire. And it's a fascinating story in history. Because really an extraordinary group of elite American men and women from elite colleges, and in those days the most prevalent colleges sending missionaries to Turkey were Mount Holyoke, Williams, Amherst, Oberlin, Columbia, Princeton, and so on. All of these passionate and highly disciplined young men and women went to Turkey, and they created a very superb educational system. And so now a huge number of Armenian Christians are getting extraordinary education, are getting an extraordinary professionalization of a kind that really was incredible. I mean, it was really anomalous, and it created a great deal of tension between them and their Muslim overlords, who resented it.
Mm. As a result of the massacres of the 1890s, Congress, the U.S. Congress, passed the first international human rights resolution in our history, condemning the Sultan who ordered the massacres. And then during the First World War, the Allies warned the Ottoman government against crimes against humanity. Other than the condemnation and the warning, was any action taken? And why was there no military intervention?
Right. Well, yes, you're noting that there were some historic landmark statements made by Americans and by the Western powers, warning the Sultan and later the Young Turks about what they were doing and calling this crimes against humanity, which is the first time the phrase was used. And as you know, Raphael Lemkin, the man who invented the term and concept genocide, did so in large part on what had happened to the Armenians in 1915, as well as what was happening to the Jews then in the 1940s. But there was no intervention. It was never backed up. I mean, as you may know, that my book makes the assertion that the Armenian cause was the first international human rights movement in American history, beginning in the 1890s and going on into the 1920s. As big as that cause was, and it was huge, and it involved cultural elites and grassroots movements simultaneously, as big as those movements were around America, there was no military intervention and no political intervention. And one of the great ironies in the history that I tell in The Burning Tigris is that it was the very Protestant missionaries who had done so much in some ways for the Armenians who, when push came to shove, persuaded President Woodrow Wilson to not declare war on Turkey. Turkey was the only central power upon whom war was not declared by the United States. And they didn't want war declared on Turkey because they were afraid that it would destroy their hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate and their century of buildings and networks all over Turkey. And President Theodore Roosevelt has some extraordinarily pithy statements about this odious hypocrisy, as he calls it, that the Protestant missionaries, the very people who are propelling the Armenian Relief Movement, are preventing the only thing that would really stop massacre, which was the declaration of war on Turkey. And I tell that story in some depth, and I hope readers will find that a very interesting, although tragic, American tale.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign County, line one.
I have two questions. First, how sensitive to the truth was Franz Werfel's 40 Days of Musa Dagh? And second, then, when you're dealing with context, doesn't the genocidal practice in the Peloponnesus sort of predate the kinds of things that you're talking about? And the Ottomans certainly were not strangers to the idea of getting rid of all opposition by getting rid of all peoples.
Right. Your first question about Franz Werfel, I'm glad you mentioned him. He has an important role to play in this narrative. He wrote the first best-selling work on the Armenian Genocide. Then it was called The Armenian Massacre, and his novel came out in the early 1930s. He was an Austrian Jew who had to flee Hitler's Nazi Germany for his life. He barely got out. He came to the United States. His novel is about a very interesting and important heroic resistance to genocide at Musa Dagh, which was near the Mediterranean Sea in the southeastern corner of what is today Turkey, right near the Syrian border. And Werfel had done a lot of research, and his novel is historically accurate. I mean, it's certainly based deeply in history. The tragedy about the Werfel story is that MGM had purchased the rights to make his novel into a film. It would have been the first feature film about the Armenian massacre, and the Turkish government pressured FDR State Department for 2 full years until the State Department prevailed on MGM to stop the making of that motion picture. That's really a scandalous piece of American history that's not that well known. I would argue that had that film been made in the 1930s, it was going to be a big blockbuster film like Gone with the Wind. The 40 Days of Musa Dagh was that kind of novel, big historic epic. It would have had a great impact on reviving the memory of the Armenian genocide, which was lost quickly. And your second question about the Greeks in the Peloponnesus, yes, I mean, one of the there were massacres. I mean, there was not a wholesale attempt to annihilate the Greeks because they were Greek, and the Greeks, of course, did achieve their independence in the 1820s. But I think the first wholesale massacre, in my knowledge of the region, happened to the Greeks on the island of Chios in 1822, right at the beginning of the movement for Greek independence. So, yes, there are precursors there.
I want to thank the listener for his call, his questions. We have to wrap up here, Peter. In terms of U.S. foreign policy today, what is the big lesson of the Armenian genocide?
Well, I think there are many contemporary lessons, and I think if we go back to the period right after World War I, we find that what had been a huge humanitarian cause in the United States was quickly abandoned for oil diplomacy in the Middle East. This was the beginning of the modern era in that way, and the Harding administration was fixated on doing anything it needed to do in order to gain control of oil fields. And a humanitarian issue caused a large human rights issue and what should have been inevitable justice for a culture that had been nearly annihilated was simply jettisoned. And I think it tells us that we have been stuck in a place where national self-interest always supersedes humanitarian issues and humanitarian necessities and human rights necessities. And I understand that nation states are built around the need for national self-interest, but it seems to me that we've had no priorities and we've had no scale of values in this zone. And I think the Armenian case has a lot to teach us about how we began on this course, a course that we're still on as we wrestle with the relationship between oil diplomacy and really the future of our whole nation in a global context.
Mm-hmm. We have to leave it there. Peter Balakian, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Peter Balakian, our guest this afternoon. He's the author of 7 previous books, including June Tree, New and Selected Poems, 1974 to 2000. His new book, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response, is published by HarperCollins.